This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. ربكم الله الذي خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش يغشي الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات بأمره ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعا وخفية إنه لا يحب المعتدين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly. And He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely, His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely, He does not love those who exceed the limits.
Our headlines: Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement agrees to an Egypt brokered truce, putting an end to 3 days of Israel's strikes on the Gaza Strip. The leader of the Islamic Jihad says Palestinian resistance groups have succeeded in their fight against Israel and will remain steadfast in their confrontation with the regime. Plus, Iran strongly condemns the desecration of the Holy Quran in Germany, urging the German government to take immediate measures to stop such insulting moves. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. Millions of mourners in Iran and across the world are making Ashura, the martyrdom anniversary of Prophet Muhammad's grandson, Imam Hussein. Every year, black-clad mourners mark the occasion with mourning processions or ceremonies held at mosques. The rituals involve beating of their chests and reciting elegies in honor of Imam Hussein, the third Shia Imam. Ashura is the 10th day of the Muslim calendar month of Muharram. It is the day when Imam Hussein and 72 of his companions were martyred in the plains of Karbala in modern-day Iraq. They were killed by forces of the tyrannical ruler of the time, Yazid, in the Battle of Karbala in 680 AD. We'll be talking to our guests, analysts, and commentators about the significance of this day in today's world and about the sacrifices that Imam Hussein and his companions made in order to safeguard the true values of Islam and also stand up against oppression and tyranny. We have two guests right now, Sayyid Kazem Rizvi. He is the director of the Allama Rizvi Foundation. He is joining us from Qom. And we have on the line Sayyid Zafar Mehdi. He is a journalist and commentator joining us from Tehran. Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us on this day, on the day of Ashura, on which Imam Hussein and his companions were martyred in 680 AD. Let me begin by Sayyid Kazem Rizvi in Qom. Almost 1,400 years ago, the Battle of Karbala occurred. Now, what do you think the significance of this battle is in today's world?
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you for this opportunity. First of all, I'd like to send my condolences to all here. the significance of this battle after all these years, as you said, almost 1,400 years ago, is that it still teaches us the lessons and the spirit of sacrifice that Imam Hussein and his companions had. Spirit of sacrifice and the need to rise up for the truth and to stand up for what is right. And we see that these lessons are applied all over the world by many of his followers and even those who take inspiration from his teachings.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. Sayyid Zafar Mahdi, perhaps one of the most notable aspects of the Battle of Karbala and perhaps in general Imam Hussein's life is the lesson of resistance. I want you to tell us, how does resistance manifest itself in today's world?
Assalamu alaikum. First of all, thank you for having me. Assalamu alaikum Abu Abdullah Hussein. When we talk about Karbala, it is of course the greatest tragedy in human history, you know. But it's not merely a tragedy, not merely an episode in history that revolves around a grief-centric ritual, you know. It is a profoundly illuminating philosophy, you know, that defines relationship between truth and falsehood, between just and unjust, between right and wrong, between dignity and ignominy. I see it as a movement, a revolutionary movement that started in the desert plains of Karbala 14 centuries ago, and that was aimed at the revival of Islamic values, that was aimed at social reformation and justice. Imam Hussein's uprising against the corrupt Umayyad ruler was not a political struggle. It was a movement, and this movement will always be relevant as long as there's corruption, as long as there's injustice, as long as there's oppression. Well, understanding the essence of Imam Hussein's uprising is essential to understand the philosophy of Karbala and the significance of these annual Muharram commemorations that we're having right now, the Azadari processions and other related events. To invoke a popular quote, every day is Ashura, every place is Karbala. This may sound cliched, but it has a deep philosophical subtext to it. You know, Muharram and Karbala symbolize the perennial struggle between truth and falsehood, which cuts across the space of the lines of time and space. You know, today, if you look around, you talk about resistance, you talk about resilience. Look at Palestine, look at Afghanistan, look at Kashmir. You know, Kashmir, Karbala is every place where there's injustice and there is resilience, there is resistance, you know. Wherever there is injustice and there is oppression exists, you see Husseini forces coming forward. And these Husseini forces are pitted against the Yazidi forces. These annual commemorations are essentially the reaffirmation of our support, of our solidarity with these oppressed people who are resisting against the modern-day Yazidis. You know, it is the reaffirmation of our pledge to the principles that were exemplified by Imam Hussein and other martyrs of Karbala. It also strengthens our resolve and conviction to speak truth to power, to fight for justice, and it gives a sense of hope and purpose to those who believe in the worthiness of their cause. For example, you see different places around the world right now who are resisting, you know, who are fighting against Yazidis of modern day. If you just look around Palestine, what's going on there in the last few days, so many people have been killed, you know. Mm-hmm. And it shows how Karbala is still relevant. Karbala is still significant. You know, that's the message of Karbala. You know, you cannot just sit back and just be a mute spectator to what's going on. You have to you have to support those who are resisting, who are fighting against Yazidis of today.
Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement has agreed to a truce with Israel following 3 days of strikes on the Gaza Strip by the regime. The Egypt-brokered truce took effect on Sunday at 23:30 local time, or 20:30 GMT. Mohammed Al-Hindi, a senior Islamic Jihad member, said in a statement that the deal includes securing the release of two of the movement's prisoners, Bassem Al-Sa'di and Khalil Awavda. The truce ended the latest bout of Israeli strikes on a besieged coastal enclave, which began on Friday. According to Palestinian Health Ministry, the Israeli strikes have killed 44 Palestinians, including 15 children, 4 women, and two senior Islamic Jihad commanders. 360 Palestinians have also been wounded. Palestinians held a funeral for Commander Khaled Mansour in the southern city of Rafah. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says assassinating Palestinian leaders will not stop resistance to the Israeli occupation. Israel also deployed artillery units and troops near the Gaza border. Meanwhile, in response to Israel's attacks, the Islamic Jihad fired hundreds of rockets at Israeli cities, including Tel Aviv, Sderot, and Ashkelon. The Secretary General of Islamic Jihad movement lauds Palestinian people's resistance against Israeli aggression, saying all resistance groups are a united front. Ziad al-Nakhala said Palestinian resistance groups will remain steadfast and determined in their confrontation with the Zionist regime. He said resistance groups have been firing rockets at Israeli targets in retaliation for the regime's acts of aggression. He noted that Palestinian people and the resistance front have secured achievements in their fight against the Israeli regime. The Islamic Jihad leader said the resistance front has set conditions for an Egyptian brokered truce to enter into effect, including the release of two of its prisoners. Nakhala said the resistance front managed to force its conditions on Israel. He also thanked Iran for supporting the Palestinian nation. Nakhala made the comments in a presser held following the announcement of a truce which ended Israel's latest bloody onslaught against the Gaza Strip. The Secretary General of Hezbollah movement says retaliatory attacks by the resistance front against Israel prevented the regime from carrying out more acts of aggression. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah made the remark in a televised address referring to a truce that took effect between Israel and the Islamic Jihad movement in the Gaza Strip. Nasrallah said it was clear that the Zionist enemy was trying to stop the conflict because it could not take more retaliatory rocket attacks from Gaza. He added that Israel's conditions didn't allow the regime to continue its military aggression against Gaza. Nasrallah also praised Palestinian people's determination in their struggle against Israel. The Hezbollah leader said resistance groups are strong enough to impose their conditions on the Zionist enemy. Iran has strongly condemned desecration of the Holy Quran and Islamic sanctities by a small group in the German city of Hamburg. Foreign Ministry spokesman said the blasphemous act, which took place outside the Islamic Center in Hamburg, is a clear example of sedition and hate-mongering. Nasser Kanani warned against dangerous consequences of such seditious and insulting moves, saying they are another face of takfiri and Daesh-like violence and extremism. He said governments that claim to be advocating freedom and human rights must oppose such moves. He also urged the German government to take immediate, strong, and explicit measures against those making such insulting moves, including through rapid judicial action. Kanoni said the global arrogance and Zionism are behind these seditious acts. He called on Muslims and Islamic countries to form a united front in the face of plots hatched by the enemies of Islam. Authorities in the Indian-controlled Kashmir have attacked a Muharram procession in the region's capital city of Srinagar. As Sayyid Ali Safi reports, a number of mourners have been injured and dozens were arrested while carrying out the traditional procession.
Scores of people were injured and many more were arrested after government forces attacked Muharram mourners in the Indian-controlled Kashmir's main city, Srinagar. Authorities had placed strict restrictions in the city and sealed the entry points with barbed wires to prevent Shia Muslims from participating in the traditional procession. On Saturday evening, authorities issued a statement upholding a ban on mourning processions in the city center. Police and paramilitary forces were deployed in big numbers to maintain order. Mobile internet services were suspended in parts of Srinagar. However, some mourners defied restrictions and poured onto the streets at many places to mourn the martyrdom of Prophet Muhammad's grandson, Imam Hussein. The government forces swung into action and hit people with canes. A number of mourners were also detained. 3 decades on, the authorities continue to prevent Shia Muslims from holding traditional Muharram procession in the region's city center, citing security reasons. The people here argue if the government can allow Hindu processions and political rallies in the heart of the city, why not Muharram procession?
See, on one hand, we see the whole security mechanism, you know, they get activated when Hindu pilgrimages are granted permissions and security arrangements are being made. But on the other hand, we see when, something related to Muslims is there, they don't grant permissions. We don't want security at the first place. We want permission so that we could carry out our religious activities.
If they have a right, Very recently, ruling BJP party held a political rally in the city center. If authorities can ensure security for that rally, why are our peaceful morning processions banned? Why this discrimination?
Two major Muharram processions in the city center were banned by authorities following the outbreak of militancy in Kashmir in 1989. The authorities fear the processions could be taken advantage of by separatist groups to stoke anti-India sentiments and hence create security threats. The religious bodies, on the other hand, term the ban as a brazen attack on their religious freedom.
Yes.
It is very unfortunate that the authorities are selectively banning religious activities of the majority population here, shutting down mosques and banning processions, even as authorities claim the situation is improving in Kashmir. These days, annual Hindu pilgrimage is underway in Kashmir, and all sorts of arrangements are being made to facilitate that. We strongly condemn discriminatory behavior of the government and hope that the good sense will prevail.
The religious bodies have also criticized the authorities for failing to make necessary arrangements, like ensuring availability of essential supplies. They say all promises and claims made by the authorities have fallen flat. Sidri Safi, Indian administered Kashmir.
A commemoration of the moment 77 years ago when the world entered the atomic age and the U.S. nuclear bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki was marked. This was the first time in humanity that weapons of mass destruction in the form of nuclear bombs were used, killing hundreds of thousands. And yet, the lessons have not been learned from this, while the U.S. is moving full speed ahead with its renovation and production of nuclear bombs.
Japan commemorates the 77th anniversary of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Survivors and relatives mark the blast anniversary with a minute of silence. The United States dropped the first atomic bomb, codenamed Little Boy, on Hiroshima on August 6, 1945, destroying the city and killing 140,000 people, mostly civilians and including many children. A second bomb 3 days later on Nagasaki killed another 70,000 and made Japan surrender and ended World War II. The bombs also left tens of thousands more dead in the months and years that followed, many from radiation-related illnesses. Many who survived the attacks continue to require welfare and medical care. During the memorial, the Japanese Prime Minister said the government would continue to support the survivors and demanded all nations to work together to promote the total abolition of nuclear weapons. It's still a goal far from being realized, but one held as strongly in the two cities that have suffered the most from such weapons. Meanwhile, the U.S., despite being the only country to have used weapons of mass destruction during a war, seems to have learned no lesson from the horrific incident.
The weapons should be eliminated from the entire earth. The United States, as a government, as a nation, has learned really no lessons. In fact, although there was a strong movement to eliminate nuclear weapons in the 1970s, resulting in the Non-Proliferation Treaty, in which the United States pledged to eliminate nuclear weapons, it did not do so, and in fact, over the last few years, has committed, from the end of the Obama administration, to a $1 trillion nuclear weapons modernization program, which runs directly in the face of any commitment to eliminating nuclear weapons. And so it's really, the United States really has nothing to say about other countries having nuclear weapons until it gets its own act together.
And with that, we'll come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Mournful is the earth as heaven starts to cry. water doubts its worth as lips begin to dry. Listen to the silence. It breaks with a sad goodbye. Amid the drums of war is a mother's lullaby. Hussein, Hussein, Hussein. Hussein, Hussein, Hussein. Hussein, Hussein, Hussein. I cry for you in pain. I cry for you. I cry for you in
of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him, or to annul my obligation to him. I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need, which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Ashura, history's most heartrending tragedy. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam and heartfelt condolences to everybody on the anniversary of history's most heartrending tragedy, which although it occurred exactly 1,383 lunar years ago, its discourse continues to bring torrents of tears to the hearts of conscientious. Today is Ashura, or the 10th of Muharram, on which Imam Hussein, peace upon him, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, drank the elixir of martyrdom in an unequal battle with the bloodthirsty Umayyad hordes, demanding allegiance to the godless rule of the tyrant Yazid. Please stay with us for a special feature in this regard. The day of Ashura dawned upon the soil of Karbala. It was the day when jihad would be in full bloom. Blood would be shed. 72 innocent lives would be sacrificed. And a decisive battle would be won to save Islam and the Ummah. It had been a few days since the water supply was cut off by the enemy to the encampment of Imam Hussein, peace upon him. Children were crying for water, and the women were desperate for water. The suffering from the thirst was too painful to bear. And despite this, not a single person in the camp made any complaints or even questioned the mission of Imam Hussein, peace upon him. Each person supported the Imam wholeheartedly and enthusiastically. In the early morning, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, went out of the encampment and saw the Umayyad commander Umar ibn Sa'd mobilizing his troops to start the hostility. The Imam was the least odd of the large army and ruled out the idea of the surrendering to the enemy. He lifted his hands in prayer to God Almighty. O Allah, it is you in whom I have trust despite all grief. You are my hope amid all violence. You are my refuge and provision in everything that happens to me. Before the actual battle was to take place, Hur, one of the commanders of the enemy force, felt his conscience violently stirring. He was in turmoil. Upon realizing the gravity of the situation, he suddenly broke away from the Umayyad camp, along with several others. They rushed toward Imam Hussein, peace upon him, to join him. Hur's heart was jumping with joy, his mind relieved of an agonizing tension. Hur's defection worried Ibn Sa'd very much, lest others do the same and defect. So he immediately unleashed an arrow towards the Imam's camp to indicate the start of the battle. This was the outset of a catastrophe and a tragic event. The Imam's loyal followers insisted on being the first to fight. Therefore, they took the brunt of the enemy attack. The battle was ferocious. Within a short time, the Imam's supporters slew a large number of the enemy fighters in self-defense. They were on the offensive and the enemy on the defensive. This caused apprehension and confusion in the enemy forces. So worried and nervous, the enemy commander-in-chief ordered reinforcements. The heroes began to fall. They were men of valor welcoming martyrdom, and they fell one after another, for the enemy was overwhelming in number. By noon time, the Imam stopped the fight to perform the ritual prayer. By this time, those left were mainly his family and a few supporters. They performed the congregational prayer, with two of the Imam's companions standing in front as shields. As the prayer was over, one of them fell dead. There were 17 arrows in his body. Ali Akbar, the eldest son of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, took his father's permission to fight and dashed toward the enemy. He engaged them in fierce fighting, falling on them like thunder, slaying numerous enemies. He continued to move forward, deep inside the enemy ranks. The enemy was overpowering in number. It overwhelmed him and targeted him with a spear that pierced his chest. As blood gushed from his wounds and martyrdom neared, the Imam rushed towards his mortally wounded son. The moment he removed the spear point from the body of the handsome youth who greatly resembled the Prophet in appearance, part of the liver came out and the soul flew to paradise. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, brought the body to the encampment amidst the wailing of the children and womenfolk. Hazrat Abul Fazl Abbas, the brother and standard bearer of the Imam's army, dashed toward the heavily guarded river to bring some water for the thirsty children. He scattered the cowardly enemies, and while he was returning on his horse with the water, he was attacked from behind date palms, and in defending himself, lost both his hands. An arrow pierced his eye, and another arrow pierced the goatskin water carrier. He was then struck a blow on his head, and as he fell from his horse, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, rushed towards him. It was, however, too late. The brave warrior breathed his last in the Imam's lap and requested him not to take his body to the encampment, since this would make the children lose all hopes of getting water, which had flowed to the ground on being hit by arrows. Then five more sons of Imam Ali, peace upon him, achieved martyrdom after heroic fight with the cowardly enemies. Earlier, the sons of Imam Hassan, peace upon him, the elder brother of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, including the 13-year-old Qasim, put up a brave but unequal fight before being martyred. The night before, when asked how he anticipated martyrdom, Qasim had said, "Sweeter than honey." The sons of the Imam's sister, Hazrat Zainab, peace upon her, that is, Aun and Muhammad, fought gallantly until they were surrounded by the enemy and martyred. Other members of the Bani Hashim clan also drank the elixir of martyrdom. Before that, scores of the loyal companions of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, fought against heavy odds and were martyred. By the afternoon, 70 brave persons had sacrificed their lives in Karbala to save Islam. All had fought under nerve-wracking conditions. Severe thirst, dehydration, exhaustion, and agonizing feeling of what would happen to the family of the Prophet afterwards. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, endured all that and more, for he saw all his beloved ones brutally cut to pieces, including children. At this moment, the Imam heard his baby boy, the six-month infant Ali Asghar, cry incessantly because of the thirst. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, now decided to take the baby in his arms, go towards the battlefield, and tell them that if they are really Muslims, they should at least provide water to the infant. The Imam wanted to awaken their conscience and stir their human feelings, but the stone-hearted enemies, instead of giving water, ordered the cruel marksman Harmale to target the infant's throat with a heavy arrow. It was a shocking moment as little Ali Asghar joined the ranks of martyrs with blood gushing out from his slit throat. The aggrieved father filled his palm with the blood of the baby and threw it upwards toward the sky, complaining to the Almighty Creator. The Umayyad hordes, through his cowardly act, proved they worse than beast. Hossein was shocked. He felt an unbearable wave of pain. The sight of the limp baby in his arms was agonizingly painful. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, was alone, one man against thousands. He took them on, fighting them bravely, and kept fighting, receiving many wounds in the process. Thousands of enemy fighters were surrounding him, but none dared to move toward him. The silence was broken when Shemr screamed for an attack, and then screamed again, threatening, and in response they attacked collectively. And one sword fell upon the imam's left wrist and deeply cut his left hand. The blood gushed like a fountain. Another sword was soon to follow and it hit his upper back. The imam felt numb as he fell to the ground, bleeding profusely. He was near the point of shock. Even though staggering, he tried to stand by leaning on his sword when he received the fatal blow. It was at this point that Shemr, whose mother was a disbeliever, came forward and severed the imam's noble head from the body. The noble head kissed often by Prophet Muhammad. Blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Shemr and others had the audacity to carry it on a lane to Yazid in Damascus, almost 1,000 kilometers away. The tragedy did not end as Ibn Sa'd ordered the horsemen to trample upon the bodies of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, and the other martyred members of the Bani Hashim clan. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, thus fulfilled the divine promise of the great sacrifice, or Zabhan Azim, as mentioned in Ayah 107 of Surah Safat of the Noble Quran, that had ransomed Prophet Ishmael in antiquity, though temporarily substituted by a ram, in order to spare the aged Prophet Abraham of such a ghastly sight. Umar ibn Sa'd and his Umayyad forces took the women and children as prisoners in shackles, put them on camels, and proceeded from Karbala to Kufa and from Thin to Damascus in Syria. At the forefront of the procession were the heads of the noble martyrs mounted on lances. Karbala is the cruelest tragedy humanity has ever seen, yet the startling, though appalling, events in Karbala proved like a powerful volcano that shook the very foundation of Muslims. It stirred them consciousness, ignorant or learned alike. For sincere Muslims, Karbala turned into a triumph. The tragic event became the very beacon of light to always remind Muslims to practice Islam honestly and sincerely, to do what is right, irrespective of consequences, and fear no one except Allah. The events of Karbala reflect the collision of the good versus the evil, the virtuous versus the wicked. Imam Hussein, as the third legitimate successor of his grandfather, the Prophet, thus safeguarded and protected Islam, thereby becoming the best of guide for Muslims. No wonder the Prophet had remarked, "Indeed, Hussein, peace upon him, is the beacon of light and the ark of salvation." The tragedy of Karbala thus taught humanity a lesson that standing for the truth and fighting unto death, for it is more honorable and valuable than submitting to the wrongful, especially when the survival of Islam is at stake.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the emergence of a new quadrilateral grouping, including India, Israel, UAE, and the U.S., and how New Delhi has very little to gain from it. And we shall also take a look at the annual Muharram commemorations in Hindu-majority India, the traditions, the history, and why Muslims are treading cautiously now.
A new quadrilateral group, abbreviated as I2U2, has recently announced its arrival on the global stage, bringing together India, Israel, the United Arab Emirates, and the United States. The inaugural meeting of the group, which was conceptualized in October last year, took place virtually last month during U.S. President Joe Biden's West Asia tour. Dubbed the West Asia Quad, I2U2 is seen as a fresh attempt by the U.S. to rally friends and allies to contain China's growing influence.
The emergence of the I2U2 group amid rapidly changing geopolitical dynamics has created a buzz in the region's intelligentsia circles. The group's stated objectives point to six mutually identified areas, including water, energy, transportation, space, health, and food security. But there's more to it than meets the eye. According to India's foreign ministry, the quadrilateral group was conceptualized on October 18 last year during the meeting of the foreign ministries of the four countries, India, Israel, the United Arab Emirates, and the United States. Ahead of the group's first virtual summit last month, a former Israeli national security advisor described the formation of I2U2 as a significant development and India's participation in it as a game changer. Regional observers believe the group seeks to integrate the West Asian region with Indo-Pacific, built on the so-called Abraham Accords that saw many Arab regimes normalizing their ties with the Israeli regime and resist growing Chinese influence in the region. While India's traditional rivalry with China and growing proximity to the Israeli regime appears to be pushing it closer to the U.S., there is a growing debate on whether these alliances with short-term gains could eventually prove detrimental to India's national interests and global ambitions in the long run.
India, which has already drawn flak for joining the informal strategic forum of Quad with the US, Australia and Japan, again finds itself in a precarious situation after joining hands with Israel, the United Arab Emirates and the United States as part of the I2U2 group. The Hindu nationalist government in New Delhi, experts believe, is being used as a pawn in a sinister game played by the US and Israel to refill the fizz that has gone out of the so-called Abraham Accords.
Political developments in the DRC in the last 3 months.
Chargé d'affaires in India's permanent mission to the UN, Ambassador R. Ravindra, told the World Body on July 27 that New Delhi has vital stakes in peace and prosperity in the Middle East. And through the I2U2 grouping, it will make significant contributions to energy, food security, and economic growth in the region. The message was not lost on regional observers, who see India serving the interests of the US and Israel through this quadrilateral alliance for short-term gains at the cost of long-term goals. With President Joe Biden's popularity ratings plummeting amid rising inflation in the U.S., Russia and China declaring the end of the old world order, and the so-called Abraham Accords withering away without any tangible results, experts believe India risks squandering its soft power through its participation in the I2U2 group. India has so far resisted calls from the West to snap ties with Moscow over the Ukraine war. But as Biden's national security advisor Jake Sullivan said recently, Washington will continue to make efforts to derail India's time-tested relationship with Russia. As someone said recently, there are moments when one has to learn to say no, to avoid making a grave folly, and to reject becoming a surrogate of extra-regional powers. The ball here is in India's court.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Zafar Khan, a retired academic and commentator from Luton. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Zafar Khan. Now, a new quadrilateral group, the I2U2, held its first summit during U.S. President Joe Biden's West Asia tour. Now, do you think the actual purpose of this formation goes beyond the stated objectives?
I think a short answer to that would be that there is a bit of both in it. I mean, the stated objectives as well as the unstated objectives. Obviously, the stated, I think it goes beyond the economic and other cooperation. There is also a strategic aspect of it, in light of the regional objectives of the United States and indeed of Israel and also India. We mustn't forget India and indeed the UAE and other states as well.
Now, Mr. Khan, a former Israeli regime official termed India's participation in the grouping as a game changer. Now, how would you interpret this?
I mean, my feeling is, coming from a Kashmiri background and having an active role in the Kashmiri political resistance for the right to self-determination, is that India is also looking for ingress into the Muslim world, particularly in the Middle East, and also wants a role to play at the world stage, and who better than the Americans being partners in this. And of course, Israel also has interests, and therefore, I think it is important for both India and Israel and others in this this, if you like, association, this sort of organization, Quad, call it Quad, for their particular interests. And India certainly has an interest. India wants to actually muscle into the Muslim world, particularly the Arab world, and to attract investment into India itself, and so on and so forth. And I think for Israel, it is more to pacify the region, to ensure that its ascendancy, both political and strategic, is maintained. So, and for United States, it has a wider objective of stopping the Chinese sort of a march towards West Asia, and indeed into Africa and so on, and Europe as well, through Pakistan, of course.
Mr. Zafar Khan, many believe the U.S. and Israel lured India into this alliance for their own interests, as it does not translate into long-term gains for New Delhi. What's your take on this?
I think the Indians have, they have a fear of the Chinese, because the Chinese have their presence in a very big way right across the borders that India and China have. So that is a factor that India wants to align with the United States and indeed the Quad, the Quad, that is the United States, India, Japan, and Australia. And this Quad, which is perhaps a relatively slightly smaller Quad, but more politically and strategically just as important for all the partners in it. And to that extent, I think India also wants to consolidate the oppressive change that it has instituted in Kashmir itself since 2019. And so I think India may have been lured by Israel and America for their own interest, but India is also here, very much playing into its own interest. And of course, it wants to influence the Muslim world. It wants to it wants to also ensure that its presence is much more acceptable within the OIC, and particularly the kind of oil rich who have the capacity, including of course Saudi Arabia, have a huge capacity to invest, which they are already doing in India itself.
I would like to thank Mr. Zafar Khan for being on the program. He's a retired academic and commentator from Luton. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Senior Indian journalist Smita Sharma cites U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan as saying that U.S. can play a central role in helping deepen Israel's integration into the region. And India also has a role to play in that, pointing to the unholy nexus. Sidna Sibal, a New Delhi-based journalist, remarks that the key announcement at the first I2U2 summit was setting up a UAE-funded $2 billion agricultural parks project in India, with technical expertise from Israel and support from the U.S. private sector. Analyst and writer Samuel Ramani, referring to the emergence of the I2U2 format, says it strengthens the so-called Abraham Accords and U.S.-India cooperation in the Middle East amid China's growing regional influence.
It's that time of the year again when Muslims across the world renew their allegiance to the glorious principles exemplified by the martyrs of Karbala more than 14 centuries ago. Like in other countries, Muharram is commemorated with tremendous religious fervor in India, home to 200 million Muslims. The annual Muharram commemorations in this South Asian country date back many centuries, with iconic cities such as Lucknow, Hyderabad, Kolkata, New Delhi and Mumbai considered traditional hubs of Azadari.
Although Shia missionaries started coming to the Indian subcontinent many centuries ago, bringing with them the enlightening message of Islam, it was only in the 16th and 17th centuries that the founding dynasty of Hyderabad, the Qutb Shahis, popularized the annual Muharram commemorations by building Ashura Khanas across the erstwhile state of Telangana.
Imam Hussein at the ground of Karbala quoted one very ecstatic words that was like, a glorious death is better than a shameful life. Give your life in the way of truth, in the way of humanity, in the way of peace, in the way of living.
Today, there are about 140 such Ashura Khanas in the city of Hyderabad that come alive every Muharram. In the 18th century, the ruling Nawab dynasty of Awadh in present-day Lucknow infused a new life to the tradition of Muharram mourning. It was this time the first Muharram procession was taken out in India in Awadh under the patronage of the ruler of the time. Today, Muharram commemorations have spread far and wide across India, with massive Ashura processions seen in major cities such as New Delhi and Mumbai. The day of Ashura is a gazetted holiday in the Hindu-majority country. Another interesting highlight of Muharram commemorations in India is how a section of Hindus, known as Hussaini Brahmins, take an active part in it. They believe their ancestor, along with his sons, fought alongside Imam Hussein in the desert plains of Karbala 14 centuries ago.
Karbala is not only related to Shia Muslims or other sects of Muslims. It is a place where peace took birth 1400 years ago and still